Hello, and welcome to ECNM On Air, a podcast series from ECNM Magazine that shares industry intelligence, insights, and opinions on all topics electrical. I'm your host, Ellen Parson, Editor-in-Chief of ECNM, and I'm here today with Denise Green, Midwest Regional Sales Manager and National Breaker Specialist with Group CBS, to talk about how circuit breaker condition affects arc flash safety. Denise presented a very popular webinar for ECNM on this topic last summer, and so we're here today to discuss some of the most pressing questions that came out of that session, and there were a lot of them. So this will just be the highlights. The webinar is available if you want to listen to the whole thing in its entirety on our website, on demand, under the premium content section of the website. So like I said, Denise is the Midwest Regional Sales Manager and National Breaker Specialist for Group CBS, and she's been in the electrical distribution industry for 35 years. Providing hands-on circuit breaker and troubleshooting service and electrical field service, as well as holding project management, operations management, and sales management positions. In addition, she's also been administering arc flash and NFPA 70E awareness training for 12 years to both electrical field service companies and commercial and industrial customers. So now that we know a little bit more about Denise, let's jump right into some questions. The webinar started out, you set that up with basically, you know, a scene. The threat of arc flash is ultimately every electrical professional's worst nightmare. And, you know, that comes with the sound, the flash of light, flames, and then smoke, all indications that an arc flash incident has taken place. So something's gone wrong, obviously, and now people and equipment are directly in harm's way. So let's get into some of these questions. To start with, I know you talked about some of the hidden electrical conditions, and people were really interested in that, that are created by the physical condition of electrical equipment that can lead to arc flash hazards. So what are some of the most important things electrical professionals should look out for?
Okay, so there's a few things. So on the operational side of the breaker, you know, the worst situation is that a breaker doesn't operate due to a lack of maintenance or inspection, and then we end up with a potential arc flash situation that is worse than could be anticipated because the breaker doesn't operate as expected. Things to look out for, a lot of it is environmentally driven. So is the equipment climate controlled? Is it warm and dry? If it's not climate controlled, are there heater strips installed and are they used and turned on? What is the physical condition of the housing of the equipment? You know, all these give us a lot of signs to what could be going on inside the cell based on the environment. You know, is there rust? Are there signs of degradation of the switchgear? Where's the switchgear located? Can the signs of rust be indicating water intrusion that you can't necessarily see, but it's running out the bottom and rusting the bottom of the equipment out? Mm-hmm. What's the atmosphere like where the equipment is in? Is it in, you know, a wastewater treatment plant where we know that the gases generated by the process aren't good for electrical components? You know, is it maybe a manufacturing stamping facility where there's lots of oil that gets vaporized in the air and coats everything? Is it a food processing facility where there's some sort of airborne contaminant that then can impact the operation of the equipment? Another one, you know, is the substation located over a cable vault that might be filled with water? That you don't necessarily think about. One that I ran into on a mezzanine, the substation was installed and there was no floor in the bottom of the substation. So it was completely open to the processes down below. You know, that's going to have a large impact on, you know, the physical condition of the equipment in that substation, especially the breakers on the bottom row, you know, that they're going to have the greatest impact to what's going on around it. And maybe are there potentially flammable atmospheric items, you know, airborne things that can cause harm to the physical condition? You know, is there coal dust? grain dust. Sugar is a really bad one, you know, facilities that make candy, you know, that sugar residue gets on everything and makes equipment not operate properly. All those kind of things, anywhere where the equipment is located that would increase exposure to this really can impact the physical condition and then consequently the operation of that piece of equipment. So there's a lot of physical signs that you can look for and consider, you know, with where your equipment is located. You know, do people prop the door open from the plant to the substation? All those kind of things impact what happens to your equipment and then consequently impacts your arc flash hazard.
Right. So there's so much to this, all of those different scenarios, and I'm sure you've seen all of them. All of these different kinds of environments that you probably no one can even believe. Now let's move into some specific questions our webinar attendees posed. We literally had hundreds of questions on this webinar, which really speaks to the importance of the topic. Not only that, but Denise's expertise in this area and how well it resonated with our audience. So let's see, Denise, one attendee is questioning whether arc flash labels can misrepresent the hazard for PPE selection. And he's asking, how will personnel know the condition inside the equipment without removing the covers?
Okay, that's a really good question, because what is written on the label is calculated for best case scenario for that equipment. So there are three condition categories that the NFPA has sort of come up with in the maintenance handbook that are directly based on how the equipment is inspected and maintained, what kind of issues were found the last time it was maintained, or has there been an extended period of time that the equipment hasn't been maintained? So, yes, the lack of maintenance directly impacts the accuracy of the label and whether it can misrepresent the PPE selection. So when safety planning is being done, job planning is being done by a qualified person, that person needs to look at all of the parameters surrounding that equipment and the project that's at hand and take those factors into account. You know, if you have a piece of equipment that has a very high arc flash hazard PPE category, you know, maybe almost at a four or at a four, and very close to that 40 calorie threshold of a PPE HRC category four, and you know that equipment hasn't been maintained or it's a very poor area, the decision very well might be, hey, we need to shut the power off somewhere else because it might be too dangerous to do it where we're standing at. So that there isn't an easy way to numerically quantify how bad it is. Looking at what the hazard is to begin with and taking those conditions into account might help people make a better informed decision about, you know, worst case scenario and what could happen.
And they might need to call in maybe additional people or a supervisor, I mean, to make that decision. Like, who would that ultimately be? Who would decide
who
that?
A qualified person, right, to evaluate that and decide how you're going to handle the situation. You know, it's really important to have those discussions on a regular basis, because in the event of an emergency, you don't have a lot of time to have those meetings and discussions. So the more frequently that these kind of conversations have in job planning and maintenance planning, the better equipped everyone is for not only those routine tasks, but then if you end up in an emergency situation, you know, on that. The other thing, and I think this goes along maybe with the next question, well, and how will personnel know inside the equipment without removing the covers?
Yeah.
So a really big indicator of that is, are there test stickers on the equipment? When's the last time it was looked at? Do you have access to those maintenance records to verify what was done during the maintenance? You know, were the pieces of equipment just closed and tripped and nothing was tested? Yeah. Was there minimal testing done, or were the breakers or devices removed disassembled, inspected, cleaned, re-lubricated, and put back together. Those pieces of information are going to help you decide how accurate that label probably is. And, okay. and you have to remember that it's always a best guess situation. So sure. that's why we do job planning and have these discussions, because we're doing this to the best of our ability based on the information at hand.
Yes.
So that's okay. that.
Right. That makes sense. So someone related says, can we still put PPE category numbers on the arc flash labels instead of the incident energy levels?
Yes. So there are three things that can be on the label that are all parallel pieces of information. It's not a requirement that all three be there, but the available instant energy can be on the label, the minimum arc rating of clothing can be on the label, or the site-specific PPE can be on the label, as long as the site-specific PPE meets or exceeds the HRC rating. So as long as one of those things is on the label, that's considered acceptable information. Okay. If the available incident energy is there, then you just refer to the table that that helps you select your PPE.
Right.
So one way or another, you can come to sort of the distilled information of what PPE do I have to wear, and the flexibility is given by the NFPA to put any of those methods on the label for selection of equipment.
Okay, perfect. So someone else is asking, I'm sure that this comes up quite a bit. People ask you this: if you find labels that haven't been updated in the last 5 years, would you consider that the breaker has been maintained or not? So like you're saying, it's like these judgment calls of like, when you find that, what do they do?
Right. So that's a very interesting question. So maintenance and condition of equipment is a completely separate item from the arc flash label.
Okay.
So just because the arc flash label says that this is a category 3, you know, it's 26 calories, you need to wear at least a 25 calorie system of PPE, that really has nothing to do with the maintenance side. So you can't assume anything just because a label has been put on.
Okay.
You know, I've seen instances where an arc flash study was done, best case scenario is used, but the equipment hasn't been maintained in 10 years. So really, the information on the label is not very useful because the equipment isn't being maintained. So no, the current label doesn't have a reflection on the actual accuracy and the maintenance. That's a best case scenario.
Right. So the recommendation is the labels are required to be reviewed every 5 years. So someone's asking more specifically, can you confirm what reviewed means in this context to satisfy this requirement or recommendation?
Sure. So the NFPA is really good about requiring record keeping. So when you have an arc flash study done, your labels are created. The 5-year rule is that someone, whether it be a knowledgeable, qualified person at your facility, whether it's someone from an outside firm, takes a look at all of that information, takes a look at your present equipment in the building, checks to see if there are any deviations, was any equipment changed, were any circuit breakers, spares put into service, and then those particular items updated. And there has to be a piece of paper with a signature on it that says our one line and labels were reviewed, no significant changes occurred in the last 5 years, and the labels are still accurate. And that needs to be dated and signed by someone so that you have a record, an ongoing record of your arc flash study and labeling. You have to consider that as a living document.
Okay.
That is going to be modified and expanded on over time. So it's not a one and done. So it's definitely what review means.
Okay.
Now, it's very important to note that the NFPA says, and they have an exception, and I'm going to read the actual standard.
Okay.
That says, unless changes in electrical distribution systems render the label inaccurate, Labels applied prior to the effective date of the addition of the standard shall be acceptable if they complied with requirements for the equipment labeling in the standard in effect at the time the labels were applied. So what that means is just because it's been more than 5 years, doesn't mean you have to create a new label. If you want to create a new label, you certainly can. But as long as the label was accurate and met all the rules at the time of creation, and that particular circuit has not changed, you don't have to do anything with the label other than document somewhere in your record keeping that it was reviewed and it's still accurate.
Okay, great explanation there. So this may relate to what you just said. So if you could clarify this, one other person is asking, you did mention in the webinar that labels are only required to be recalculated if the equipment changes. So does this include situations where some spare breakers on the gear are then utilized? Would it then have to be recalculated?
Yes. Yes. So if you are putting a spare breaker into service that was not there, that breaker needs to be calculated for whatever it's feeding, what its protective device is, so that the downstream, you have downstream information available. Mm-hmm. That also might impact the main, okay, and because it changes the load in the substation, it might make the main have a little bit lower issue. It might change, whatever the case may be, that might change. If a spare breaker gets put into service, it's possible that the settings on the main might have to be adjusted to accommodate that additional load. So that would need to be calculated. Another common one is if a transformer gets replaced, especially a distribution transformer in a substation, the impedance is never going to be the same as the original. So that's going to change the rating at the main. And so there will need to be some recalculations at that point, to make sure that the sticker is accurate at the main, and that, are the fuses the same in the switch feeding the transformer, or did that change because the fuses had to change? So it could be an expansion of items that need to be recalculated based on which piece of equipment changed.
Okay. Yeah, okay? That definitely answers that. So shifting gears a little bit, someone else is asking another question about how do we determine the change in risk level due to the condition of equipment?
Okay, so the risk level is always going to go up as the condition of the equipment goes down.
Okay.
So the longer the maintenance cycle, the more deficiencies that were found in previous testing cycles. If you have a substation tested and one breaker tested bad the last time, and it's been 5 years since the last test, that's going to be one sort of parameter. If you tested a substation and 3/4 of the breakers tested bad the previous time, that's going to be an indication that the rest of the breakers, very well might see an issue this time when they're tested. Protective equipment a lot of times has a finite lifespan. There are certain trip units that are getting to end of life based on their internal components. So you might see higher than normal failure rates. Okay. So you have to be conservative in your thinking that the hazard is increasing the worst condition your equipment is in. Now, is there a way to easily quantify that? Not really. So that's why I suggest a very conservative approach to how you're going to look at that hazard.
Okay. So more specifically along those same lines, there's some questions on trip time. How is the trip delay time quantified for those that are in poor maintenance environment? And then subsequently, what conditions are taken into account in determining the delayed trip time practically?
Okay, so as I said, in the NFPA 70B, it's a really great resource. That's the standard for equipment maintenance. Mm-hmm. And they have come out with 3 classifications of condition with a really easy chart to help you determine what the condition of that equipment is and how you should modify your frequency of inspection and test to get back to a good, a better condition. So that's really what you should look at on on how to look at the poor maintenance and how that's going to affect your delayed trip time. You know, the other thing is the duration in between maintenance cycles. So generally speaking, lubricants have about a 5-year lifespan. So we see a lot of people that are modifying shutdown periods and extending that time due to whatever process that they do, you know, environmental factors, cost, all of that. Mm-hmm. And all the time extended over that 3 to 5 years is going to negatively impact that delayed trip time. So your piece of equipment is not going to operate as intended the further out it gets from that service date. So that's kind of a consideration. And then also the environment that we talked about before. You mm-hmm. know, if your piece of equipment is in a very, very poor environment or environment that is not conducive to steel, yeah. copper, silver, you know, that's going to impact that potential delay, trip delay time and okay. and give you a longer time that then increases your arc flash hazard.
Okay. And then you may have already gone over this, but then the final question on that was, does the trip time include actual clearing time?
So that's an interesting question. So there are some trip time tests that involve actual clearing time, and those are usually done on yard equipment with transducers and extra components to measure the trip time, and that actually measures from the time that the circuit breaks to when, or the actual copper breaks to when the actual circuit is disrupted. Mm-hmm. Most trip timing tests are only from the time of trip signal to when the copper breaks, and it doesn't take any arcing or arc extinguishing into account. That is really a bigger issue on medium voltage air equipment. Low voltage air equipment is basically going to be about an immediate, and it will be about the exact same time as the copper breaks, your arc is going to break. As long as the breaker functions properly and opens all mm-hmm. the way. Vacuum equipment is going to be basically that exact same time as soon as the copper separates, you know, and your circuit is open, there's not going to be any kind of added time on mm-hmm. your trip time. So really it's more of a medium voltage and high voltage air equipment. You know, I'm sure everyone has seen videos of them opening switches in a yard and there's a big lightning bolt that lasts an extended period of time over the normal, you know, switch opening. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, it's going to be the trip time is going to be pretty close to the actual.
Okay. Someone is asking about one of the methods of the reliability-centered maintenance methodology is run to failure. Should that be considered in incident energy analysis itself?
Okay, that's a very interesting question. I know a lot of utilities operate under the run to failure, especially in remote locations. Mm-hmm. There are some industries that do that. So yes, it should be considered. It's definitely a consideration when you're planning maintenance and you're looking at the label and when the last time it was operated. The run to fail is very hard to calculate because you could say, okay, we'll take 2 seconds and we'll put that in as a trip time instead of, you know, 0.05 seconds for, you know, an instantaneous fault and mm-hmm. calculate what that would be and put that on the label, assuming worst case scenario. But in a run to fail situation where equipment isn't regularly maintained, there is no easy way to calculate it. You know, IEEE, even though they have some fantastic formulas, they can't take every situation into account. So right. normal labels are calculated on best case scenario. The other thing is in the run to fail, people have different definitions of run to fail. So some companies might say, okay, once a year, we're going to open and close our equipment 10 times and then put it back in service. So while we're not lubricating it or testing it, we're at least exercising it. Other companies might leave a piece of equipment closed for all eternity until it does fail. And that's going to have two very different outcomes as far as available incident energy, because it's, even though it's a run to fail, some companies do things in the middle where other companies don't. It also is a little bit different based on what kind of equipment you're talking about. So if you're talking about molded case breakers that are a sealed unit, that's got a little bit different approach because those are considered almost lifetime lubrication as compared to a regular circuit breaker, you know, that is an air or vacuum device that may be bolt in, maybe draw out, but, or an insulated case breaker that has a regular maintenance schedule prescribed by the OEM. So yes, it needs to be considered. Is it easy to calculate? No.
Okay. Just like a lot of these things is so, it's very sophisticated. It's not so simple here. I'm so glad you're answering all these and such great explanations. So someone, I don't know if this would be NFPA 70B, but someone's saying, is there a single source document, standard or advisory that establishes nominal maintenance for low voltage switch gears, MCCs, ATSs, MTSs?
The answer is sort of yes. Okay. Obviously, it's more convenient to have one document. The OEM maintenance schedule for that equipment is the gold standard. Okay. I do realize, though, that in a plant, when you have, you know, 25 different manufacturers, different vintages, all of that, for ease of service, it is nice to refer to one single document. The parallel use of the NFPA 70B along with the NHTSA MTS, so that's the maintenance testing standard, would probably be the two best documents to use to try to get as close to a single source as possible. The ATS, the acceptance testing standard, is for new installation. You know, that's acceptance testing on installation. But for existing gear, it would be the maintenance testing standard and then the NFPA 70B. So those both have suggested test procedures, and the 70B definitely has suggested timeframes on that if you can't find or want to consolidate from OEM documentation.
Okay, right. Here's a quick one. Someone says, how often should 3K amp breakers, main breakers, be tested, and how about main sub breakers?
Well, that kind of goes along with our last one. So the breaker should be tested as often as the OEM prescribes the testing. So that's the technical answer. I don't know if they were referring to like a 3000 amp molded case breaker that's bolted in, you know, to a panel, or they're referring to a 3000 amp medium voltage breaker or a 3000 amp low voltage breaker. All of those other devices, you know, should be tested at a frequency that is generally every 3 to 5 years. Okay. The biggest thing on that is the equipment owner needs to consider how important is that piece of equipment to their operation and to what their procedures are and what their production is in their facility. You know, if you have a piece of equipment that is extremely vital to your revenue stream or whatever the case may be, you as an equipment owner need to evaluate how often do we need to test that based on its importance in our system. You know, and a petroleum distilling facility, you know, like a petroleum factory might say, hey, our petroleum line to make gasoline is our most important thing. And we're going to make sure that we test that every 2 years because that's how we make our money. And we're going to put our parking lot lights every 5 years because that's not as big of a deal. You know, our administrative building, you know, now that people know how to work remotely, we're going to put that on the 5-year cycle, because if the administrative building went down, people could still do their jobs from elsewhere, but we cannot under any circumstances interrupt our revenue stream. So those are some choices that play into the minimum maintenance period from the OEM.
Okay.
And then the main sub breakers. So same thing. You know, what is the maintenance recommendation from the OEM? What is the criticality of that equipment? You know, and what is the installation, you know, of that? Is it a panel board? Is it a fuse disconnect? You know, if it's a fuse disconnect, you know, as a sub panel, you know, and it's not really a breaker, you know, operating it once a year might be adequate, you know, in between testing. So it's really a combination of OEM recommendations, environment, and criticality of circuit.
Okay. This is great stuff. I need to make sure we get this podcast in front of all these people that so they can hear all these great answers. Someone's asking more of a procedural question, it looks like. Is every facility owner required to perform an arc flash study, or can that analysis be assigned to the maintenance company?
Okay. So in 1970, there was an act that came out that was the Employee Health and Safety Act. And in that act, it said it's a business owner's requirement to inform their employees of hazards at their workplace. Mm-hmm. So fast forward to the NFPA, and over 20 years ago, the NFPA started the requirement of safety labeling on equipment. Initially, it was just a voltage level, and this is a hazard. Mm-hmm. And then it became, we have the tools to generate the information so the people standing in front of the equipment know exactly what the hazard is. And it is a requirement that if a piece of equipment is examined, serviced, maintained, or operated, that it have a label. Now, people say, well, I don't operate it. Only my maintenance company operates it. That mm-hmm. does not cover all of the times when in an emergency, you might have to have an employee open that breaker.
Okay.
And if that employee doesn't understand and you don't understand the hazard, then you're putting yourself and the employee at risk because you don't know the hazard. So the short answer is yes, you are required to have labels calculated. Now, there are some, you know, caveats to that. You know, if you have very low amperage equipment, single phase, below 240, you know, the hazard is not going to be very great. You know, possibly, you know, some mains be calculated and some just caution labels put on, you know, but anything of significance in a facility that can pose a hazard needs to have a label and so that the hazard is known.
Okay. We're getting kind of to the end of these. Let's see. A few of these are more best practices questions, common themes that came up in the webinar. So I don't know, Denise, do we want to, you kind of already touched on this one about the atmospheric environment. Do you have anything else on that?
Well,
Why is it so important to assess the atmospheric environment?
So a good example of that, if you're not aware, if equipment is in someplace like a wastewater treatment facility, there are airborne chemicals, sulfur-based chemicals that mm-hmm. are very, very detrimental to not only silver plating in distribution equipment, but to electronics and to moving joints. So if you have a lot of electrical equipment with solid state protection on it, or little ice cube relays that they call it or whatever, those are very susceptible to sulfur-based products, and the actual circuit boards get degraded sometimes very, very quickly. So that even though you don't think about it, that, yeah, it doesn't smell great, but is that really that big of a deal? It can be a huge deal. You know, it can cause very high resistance connections inside a circuit breaker where it's not easily accessible to fix, you know, so then you can get overheating on circuits, you can get unbalanced loads all the way through to failure of trip units. And so you have protective devices that are completely non-functional that you don't even realize are non-functional. Wow. So it can be a very large hazard. So that's how, you know, those environments can affect that. We talked about grain a little bit. Grain is terrible. Those kind of facilities, it gets inside mechanisms, and then you have actual physical binding that happens because the breaker can't open properly because there's contaminants in bearings, hinges, all of that. So that definitely affects, you know, those things really affect that.
Hey, it comes into play. What maintenance practices or lack thereof, someone asks, contribute the most to electrical risks with circuit breaker equipment and why?
So the biggest thing is time, the time interval between maintenance cycles. So that's probably the biggest one. The second one, I think sometimes there is a desire to just operate the piece of equipment and test the trip unit, and that's all you do to it. The disadvantage with not doing physical inspections, you know, partially disassembling the piece of equipment, looking in to see what is the condition of the contacts, the arcing contacts, are there any broken pieces inside that you can't see? Are there any bumpers or bearings that are worn that are causing, you know, that can cause an issue? Is the silver plating degraded to the point of now we have terrible contact resistance, you know, and our piece of equipment is not operating as designed, you know, and we have much higher resistance in our circuits, especially if it becomes unbalanced over the three phases, you know, it causes our rest of our equipment not to operate properly. It can also cause secondary problems because downstream equipment might be very, very sensitive to phase unbalance. So you can have a piece of equipment in a substation cause problems way down the stream because that is very, very looking at a very, very tight tolerance for phase balance. So all of those things contribute to electrical risks and frankly, operation of your facility. So those are, you know, not taking the time to do a thorough cleaning and testing and inspection of your equipment combined with long maintenance intervals. Those are probably the two biggest hazards.
And it seems, you know, some of this seems like common sense, but then it can turn into like serious problems that are very advanced. It's not so simple.
Exactly.
You don't even realize it.
Right. Exactly. It ends up that your facility is cruising along until all of a sudden one day it isn't. And then you find out that the problem is a lot bigger than anticipated. It's not just this little problem at a feeder bucket on a motor control center. It's now all the way back at the primary substation, you know, because that problem translated all the way through the distribution system.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. Thank you so much for answering all these and making this very complicated information understandable. I know I learned a lot today, and I know the listeners will too. Did you have any final thoughts on anything really, or the most common issues? You really kind of talked about that are typically found, how those relate to arc flash hazards, or anything else you want to add, words of wisdom?
No, just the frequency of service, and certainly having the mindset of, you know, something that hasn't been looked at, operated, or tested, you're sort of in a zone of blissful ignorance. You know, it's not the, oh, we've never had a problem with that breaker in 25 years. Mm-hmm. It should be, why haven't we had a problem with that breaker in 25 years? Does it even work? You know, that needs to be sort of a question, you know, that you ask in the process of, you know, looking at your whole system and looking at your reliability, you know, and your longevity, because the better you take care of your equipment along the way, the more years of service you get out of it, which is at the end of the day, a money-saving endeavor.
Which might not be, you know, human nature is just ignore things, but being proactive, it sounds like in these cases, is going to really pay off, because then you're going to be like the forensic investigator having to figure out what caused all of these things. And then
Life extension by proper care is almost a guarantee. almost a guarantee. If you maintain your equipment, you're going to get more life and more use out of it.
Okay, well, that sounds like a great point to end on. Good advice. So looks like we're about out of time for today. So I want to thank Denise Green so much for sharing her industry insight, knowledge, and experiences with us today on identifying and preventing arc flash events in conjunction with circuit breakers. In closing, I also like to thank managing editor Ellie Coggins and editor Michael Morris for editing and putting these podcasts together. For more information, visit our website at ecmweb.com. This podcast is produced by ECNM Magazine, part of the portfolio of Endeavor Business Media Publications. Well, I think that's it for now. I'm Ellen Parsons signing off of ECNM On Air. Please let me know if you have any podcast topics you'd like to listen to in the future. And don't forget to check out our website for great content resources for electrical construction professionals. Thank you and have a great day.